docket.
Stephen M. Collette against Gary B. Corvana et al., Kevin Martindale, Lee Allen, Todd and Carol, James E. Bridges Jr., Christopher J. Beeson, Lee Kelly.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, my name is Kevin Martindale. I'm here today on behalf of Gina Collett, the appellant in this matter, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
This is a case that originated in the Norfolk Circuit Court and was dismissed on demur. The fundamental problem can be summarized very quickly in this way. Ms. Collett has an old home located in the Ocean View section of Norfolk, and the neighbors on either side of her made topography changes and other land alterations that caused massive amounts of runoff to drain into Ms. Collett's property. This is not a situation where the land was naturally higher. The land was made to be higher, both on her left and her right.
Counsel, may I ask you this? It seems as though the trial judge understood your complaint, and candidly, as I read it, I do as well, as merely saying that these topographical changes increase the surface water flow. But Mullins and Mason and several other cases from this court say that under the modified common law rule, that alone is not enough. It has to be something rather extraordinary. That topography changes, for example, in Mullins, it was a development of the piece, there was gradations made for the, at various elevations, and there was buildings. And it clearly enhanced the flow of water, in that case, fairly dramatically. But the court held under common law that this was not actionable unless you divert a stream or something, you know, pretty much well over the top, well beyond what you would expect someone to be able to do with their property. Why is the trial court's judgment here unsound, in your opinion?
First of all, to address Mullins v. Greer from 1984, that was a trial ruling, and there was an order to remove an embankment, and that was upheld. And it was found at trial, and then there was deference on appeal, that Mullins acted unreasonably. Now you come forward to the Curpio case from 2012, and you have a laundry list of complaints. That was a case that came to the court after having been dismissed on demur, and there were 10 specific things listed that were complained about. In this case, Ms. Collett has listed 5 of those 10, specifically regrading, elevation changes, dumping of fill, a failure to control drainage, runoff running onto her property. And in the Curpio case, I think a couple of the important takeaways are that, number one, there has been no heightened pleading standard that has ever been announced. So it's not like a fraud case or a defamation case.
Well, true, but under the modified common law rule, there are certain things you have to allege, and you can't just allege conclusions of law. You have to allege some facts.
Right, and so the facts that we have alleged are that, for example, in paragraph 1 of the last version of the complaint, that the defendants are directing massive quantities of runoff and pollutants from their properties onto Ms. Collett's property, causing damages that are significant and ongoing. Paragraph 10, the manner in which the adjacent properties have been developed, maintained, and altered has been unreasonable, careless, and reckless. Paragraph 11, they have created and are maintaining conditions that are annoying, obnoxious, offensive, irritating, and hazardous.
But those are legal conclusions.
Well, paragraph 13.
The facts appear to be on one side that they put mulch down, and on the other side they put gravel down on the parking lot.
Right. For example, on the gravel issue, that it was done twice, raising their property 4 inches each time, and thereby causing this increased flow of water into Ms. Collett's property, thus causing her all these damages. And what we have pled is that it is unreasonable and it was unnecessary. They didn't need to do it that way. They
made no effort. Wouldn't an ordinary property owner think that they can put gravel down in their parking lot, and if it increases it a few inches and the additional runoff, isn't that the whole point of the common law rule?
Well, I think respectfully, I think that the point of the common law rule is that you have to do things that are reasonable in nature, and that is a fact-driven inquiry that can't be resolved on demur. The way that this is pled is that they have done many of the same things that were found to be, at least at the demur stage, found to be inappropriate in the Curpio v. Hicks case. And as pointed out in Curpio, you can't resolve reasonableness on demur. We say it's unreasonable. I assume they feel that their conduct is reasonable. That's something that has to be resolved by a trier of fact after development of the record and the presentation at trial. And so we contend that we have brought forward many of the same types of things that you see in the Curpio case, and that consistent with what Mullen says, that you know this is going to take an evidentiary proceeding in order to determine whether it was reasonable or unreasonable the manner in which they have modified their property, knowing full well, as we have pled, that they have dramatically increased the runoff into Ms. Collett's property. I simply contend on behalf of Ms. Collett that the trial judge made the mistake of substituting his judgment too quickly, and the ruling was inconsistent with the demur standard.
I hear what you're saying to Justice Kelsey's question, counsel, but when I look at Perpiel and I look at your pleading, we went through great pains in Perpiel to list about 9 facts that they pled. As I read your pleading, I see the 2 facts that Justice Kelsey has just mentioned, the dumping of gravel and the dumping of mulch. And all of our cases seem to say that if that is all that you have done, you have improved your lot, you have attempted to keep the water from washing your lot away, that that's not actionable. I'm failing to see the facts in your pleading that would get us to pass the demur stage.
If you take a look at page 8 of the reply brief that I submitted, what I did there is put a block quote from Curpio, and there was a listing of 10 particular facts in the Curpio opinion. And I bold printed numbers 4, 5, 6, 9, and 10, which I believe to be the most significant of the 10 items listed anyway. For example, did extensive regrading of the property, changed the elevation of the property, brought in additional fill dirt. Number 9, did not use proper drainage controls. 10, failed to control sediment loads and siltation running onto the Kirkwood's property. Those allegations are very similar. Some of them are identical to the allegations that have been made by Ms. Collett. She talks about one of the properties being having fill dumped in the form of gravel twice, each time raising 4 inches. The other side, dumps of mulch and grading so that the property, once again, drains into Ms. Collett's property. So I believe that what has been approved in Curpio as being sufficient would also indicate that the pleading brought forward on behalf of Ms. Collett should be deemed sufficient as well.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. It seems to me that the disconnect is between the facts you've alleged and your argument, or I call it argument, your pleading that was unreasonable, careless, and reckless. It seems like the facts you pled could certainly be read to just say that they did things to get the water off of their property, but not in an unreasonable, careless, or reckless way. So that's my question is, where in your pleadings do you provide the facts that show that the things they've done constitute unreasonable, careless, and reckless?
Well, if the way that the pleading is organized, the first part of it talks about problems common to both of them. I talk about the modifying the topography, that's paragraph 13. Talk about the effect of the modification of the topography, how it creates standing water for days at a time. Talk about how they've developed, maintained, and altered their property in a manner that's careless, unreasonable, and reckless. And then we get into some specifics relating to each of them. The Court of Honor is at paragraph 16 through 19. We talk about a March 2010 gravel dump, an August 2013 gravel dump without a permit that was actually stopped. We talk about some of the comments that were made by Mr. Cordovana, thus indicating his intent or his carelessness, the fact that he was doing things without any regard at all for his neighbor. And if you look at the cases, they talk about whether or not the actions that are taken in fighting off the water are reasonable, or, by contrast, is the person doing it heedlessly, without any care for the impact on the neighboring properties. If you look at the particulars relating to hail, we talk in paragraph 21 about the mulch dumping and how it made it much worse. And then once again, we talk about conversations, paragraphs 25 through 26, where he made comments to the effect he just doesn't care. And we would argue that those would be admissions appropriate
to
trial.
So basically the only 2 facts you have is you're dumping mulch on one side and dumping gravel on the other.
In addition to the way in which it was graded. that it was entirely unnecessary to grade it so that it drains to Ms. Collins' property.
I think that's the problem I'm having with the argument that I need you to help me with. When I look at Mason, Mason is pretty close to your case. The allegation, the complaint was that the neighbor filled in a depression in a low area. And the notice of motion of judgment had two counts and used pretty much the language your complaint used, that the natural flow was directed in a wanton, unnecessary, and careless manner, that they graded the fill down to the line of the plaintiff's property, negligently, unnecessarily pouring over great amounts of water, blah, blah, blah. The court held that that failed to make out a cause of action. In fact, explicitly said that, failed to make out a cause of action under either count of the notice of motion of judgment. Because under the common law rule, you have a right to fill depressions, you have a right to build, you have a right to put mulch down, you have a right to put gravel down. And that's the baseline. No one has to say, as I understand the common law, boy, if I put 4 inches of gravel down, that's going to put a little more water, or for that matter, a lot more water on my neighbor's lawn.
That's what made it, Mr. Martin, that your allegations are that you actually agree with what Justice Kelsey just said, but you couldn't put the gravel down or the mulch down, for example, in a manner that created, for example, a berm that would then cause the water to be discharged from the berm onto the property. And that's where the reasonableness comes in.
Yes, sir.
So I take it that you don't disagree with what Justice Kelsey said. It's just that you want the opportunity to have expert witnesses testify that the manner in which they did it was unreasonable. Is that fair?
That's exactly correct, Chief Justice. What we're trying to do is to present the evidence to show that the manner in which it was done was unnecessary, it was heedless, it was careless. It was done without any regard for the consequences to neighboring properties. And that's consistent with Cooper v. Horn. It's consistent with the McGee versus Tidewater Railway Company, Tate v. Ogg. The principle of all these cases is that at trial, we determine whether or not it was reasonable. We determine whether or not it was merely trivial or occasional, which would not be good enough to grant a plaintiff relief, or is it something different from that? And we have pled that it is a constant problem.
Did you plead there was a gravel berm constructed that changed the natural surface flow into a channel? Is that what you pled?
No, what we pled is that the topography was altered in such a manner that it has caused a massive increase in quantity of water and pollutants to drain into Ms. Collins' property as opposed to draining to somewhere else such as the street. And I see that I'm running out of time. If I may reserve the final part for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court again. My name is Christopher Wimkin. I represent two of the appellees, Gary and Margaret Cordovana. I'll be using half the time reserved for the appellees and then yield the remainder to Mr. Fiorella, who represents the other defendants in this matter. I guess I'll begin where we left off with the appellant indicating that it's his desire to have, or that the trial court should have given him a further opportunity to develop the facts in this case. However, the matter that's before us today is on a second amended complaint, and I think it's important to note that the trial court did give the appellant two opportunities to plead the additional facts that would bring them within the common law rule regarding the flow of surface water. If we look at the facts that are alleged as to my clients, the Cordovanas, I think as the court has already noted, what we're talking about is an allegation in the second amended complaint that they added gravel to their parking lot, which raised the level, which as I believe the court has already recognized, is really a situation that's controlled by the Mason v. Land matter that's already been decided. But I think it's also important to note that the allegations against both defendants, but my client in particular, go further than saying that it was somehow unreasonable. They attempt to impose an affirmative duty on my client to drain the water to the street. And if we look at, for instance, paragraph 18 that was in the second amended complaint that discusses the adding of the gravel, it specifically raises the issue not that the the height of the property is raised, but that in doing so, the Court of Bonas did not affirmatively take control of that water and drain it to the street. And I would suggest that has never been the duty that is on a landowner under the common law. Rather, the appellant is relying upon the statutory authority or the Norfolk City Ordinance at 37-16B, which does use language about draining, but as is set forth in our brief, that particular city ordinance is solely limited to the control of rats and mosquitoes, which is not the problem about which the appellant is complaining. Had she been had a problem from rats and mosquitoes emanating from my client's property, perhaps that statute or that ordinance might apply, but in order for her to rely on that statute, she would need to have pled facts showing that she was...
Well, that might go to the negligence per se question, but I don't read this pleading as relying on the statute for the common law issues.
Well, the reason I say that is because the allegations relating to draining to the street are intertwined with the factual allegations that are pled against the defendants in this case. That's why I cited to like paragraph 18, which is one of the factual allegations. But I would submit that the all of the facts are premised on the idea that appellant has put forth that the defendants had an affirmative duty to control the flow of that water and drain it to the street.
I'm not sure I read their complaint that way. I mean, you put allegations in a complaint, you sort them out at trial so long as you've reached this basic threshold. Perhaps they had no duty to direct it to the street. Perhaps they had a duty not to direct it to a neighbor's property. That's what I understand their complaint to be. So if there is gratuitous language in there that, yes, and they should have directed it to the street, well, it might be gratuitous, it might not be necessary, it might not even be the duty. But when you separate all that out, and then you look in the complaint to see, well, is there a proper duty that is alleged? I guess I'm wondering, if you allege all of these things and you allege that it was unreasonable, why doesn't that get you over demur in order to allow this to be a matter of proof at a trial?
I believe that, first of all, that they haven't alleged anything that takes it outside the modified common law rule simply by saying you added gravel and changed the topography. That's the Mason v. Lamb. But I believe the language about unnecessary is simply a legal conclusion that is a recitation of language from one of the cases, but there are no facts showing it was somehow unnecessary.
We're at the pleading stage. I mean, when you have an automobile accident case, for example, you say, you know, Mr. Jones operated his vehicle on West Broad Street in the city of Richmond in a reckless and careless manner and caused a collision with Mr. Johnson. That's sufficient. You can get to the facts later. I'm concerned not about whether or not Mr. Martingale can prove his case. I'm concerned about whether or not he has the opportunity to prove his case.
Well, I would submit that the complaint would need to at least contain some fact that, if proven true, if he developed the evidence, would support a finding of negligence, or if that's the cause of action we're talking about. But in this case, the only facts are ones that show the landowners taking activities that they are legally entitled to take.
Counsel, is the common law rule a negligence tort, or is it a trespass tort?
The context in which I think the case law treats it has always been has really been more in the trespass context, just water flow, you know, water being channeled from one property to another. I'm not sure what the negligence would necessarily be. I would suggest it's traditionally more in the trespass context.
I guess the question maybe you're getting at is the pleading requirements different for negligence than for trespass?
I think that either way, the appellant would still have to plead some facts showing that the landowners undertook some action or inaction that creates liability, whether it be under nuisance, trespass.
Well, they have to show duty, breach of that duty, and then proximate damages proximately caused by that breach, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, those elements would be required for the
action. The requirement on the trespass count of unreasonableness and wantonness and so forth, that's not part of negligence, is it?
Well, because the common law duty specifically talks about there being no liability but for doing something in an unreasonable, wanton manner, that language has been applied in other surface water cases dealing with trespass. So that same analysis has been
For trespass, but not for negligence.
I don't believe any of them were for negligence, to the best of my recollection.
Okay.
Is your view of the surface water law that it's a heightened pleading requirement? Is that I'm trying to square surface water with Rule 318 allegations of negligence?
I don't think that the case law specifically says that there is a heightened pleading standard, but I do think it supports the proposition that you have to state some facts to show that you are operating within an exception to the modified common law rule, and that those facts are simply absent in this case.
What kind of facts would it be? I mean, are there magic words like you got to say berm, or you got to say mountain, or you got to say ditch, or you got to say something like that? That's a fact that I can work with. I mean,
yeah, and I don't know that there is a magic word, but for instance, in the example of diverting a natural course of water, might be something that could be done. You know, someone could plead facts that said there's an existing channel for drainage. It was changed to divert it to that property. It was not necessary to do that because there was an alternate location for it to go.
Paragraph 15, the gravel was graded in such a manner as to ensure that the water would flow from the Port of Anna's property onto Colette's property.
Do you have to call that a ditch? What the word?
I don't think that you have to use the word ditch, but in terms of the grading of the property, I think that still falls under Mason v. Lamb and the language that Justice Kelsey was talking about earlier, where the court had looked at the landowners increasing the level of the property and grading it to the neighboring roller rink in that case, which altered an existing depression where water was collecting. Certainly that ensured that water flowed onto the roller rink property, and it happened on more than one occasion, as the court described the facts in that case, but yet found that that still did not take it outside the modified common law rule. So, at this point, I apologize.
There are really two issues. One is the grade. The other is the imperviousness. I have a completely raw lot, particularly in an area such as yours where you don't have clay underlying it. It's going to be completely pervious. The water is going to run off to some extent, but a lot of it's going to go into the soil. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, now, let's say that I build a house on that lot, and I do not like vegetation, period. And so I decide that I'm going to make my lot totally impervious. I'm going to make the entire thing cement. And obviously, I'm going to grade it so that the high point is at the middle, because the water's got to go somewhere. I'm not going to have a pool on my own lot. So I have turned my lot, by grading and by increasing the imperviousness, all of the water is going somewhere else. Is that reasonable?
I think that, I mean, under those facts, whether it was reasonable and necessary,
it's what I wanted to do, and I'm the lord of my own castle.
whether you would have an affirmative obligation to, or whether that was necessary, given whatever the circumstances of the layout of that lot was, to provide for some type of alternate drainage. There may be an argument in the case that that might be unnecessary, but I don't think that that's analogous to the facts that...
But what we're struggling with is it's merely different in degree. It's not different in kind. Gravel is impervious. So the imperviousness of the lot has been changed in a manner that benefits your client and harms the next-door neighbor. The grade has been changed in a manner that benefits your lot and harms the next-door neighbor. What we have to grapple with is, does it fall within curpial or outside of curpial, and how do we draw that line? He says, you got 5 out of 10, I'm in. You say, it's got to be something more than that.
Well, I'm of course looking at my client, and those 5 out of 10 don't exist as to my client.
Okay.
There's no issue about vegetation. I don't think he's raised the issue in the complaint about imperviousness from just adding gravel. All it is...
But gravel, I think we can take judicial notice. Gravel is impervious. It doesn't soak into the gravel. It's got to go around it.
But I don't
upon how much compaction there is, obviously. I mean, if you just throw gravel out, it's going to go around it and stay on your lot. But if you compact the gravel, it's not.
Yes, and we don't have any of that alleged in the complaint here. But in connection to curpial, which did have a long litany of factors that were taken as a whole to determine whether or not it was unnecessary or wantonly done. But as we look at the case against the Court of Anna's, what we're looking at is solely adding gravel, and really that the lot got higher. And some
how much higher did the gravel increase the elevation of that aspect of the lot?
Going by what's alleged in the complaint, I think he alleges that each time, once in 2010 and then 3 years later, that each time raised it 4 inches, without talking about whatever changes might have happened in between as to the gravel, whether it went up or down. But somewhere in the nature of 4 to 8 inches is what's alleged in the complaint.
All right. Now, you had wanted to save some time for Mr. Fiorella, who has his own set of clients. I think now's about the time to do that. Mr. Fiorella, come to the podium. Madam Clerk, put the timer up to 5 minutes, and we will give Mr. Martingale additional time as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. Police Court, my name is Todd Fiorella. My facts are completely different than the Court of Honest. I'm the neighbor who owns half of a duplex who put some apparently mulch on the property. And the questions, I mean, maybe I'm just dumb because I'm from Ocean View as well. It's a flood zone. And the water floods. It floods everywhere. And what we're dealing with is it is important to have sufficient facts in this instance to compel somebody to go to trial on this matter. This is not a simple negligence matter. This is a trespass issue under common law. And under common law, there is no cause of action. There are exceptions to the common law that give you a cause of action. And cases that have given where you've allowed plaintiffs to go forward have been cases, well, the Curpio case listed a strong set of facts and circumstances. And importantly, when it comes to my client as well, they gave a year when everything was done. In this instance, one of these houses, it was built in 1955. These lots have been there for a long period of time. My client is not the original owner of the house. He didn't do any of the grading. We don't even have an opportunity to plead that at this point because the facts aren't sufficient for my client to know what they're talking about. When was he supposed to have done this? In 2007, in 2005, in 2002? Nothing is alleged. It wasn't two opportunities to amend this pleading. It was, I believe, three. There was an original complaint filed against two individual defendants. They then filed demurrers. There was an amended complaint filed for both of those individuals. And then the cases were consolidated, and then there were two amended complaints after that. And the court said, tell us the facts. Kept saying, tell us the facts.
Judge Martin at some point made clear to the plaintiffs that if there are facts that they need to plead that he is not aware of, they need to tell him.
That's correct. And it wasn't just that. It was, you know, tell us specific facts that will bring you in the purview of curpial. And as things were getting changed, I know there was a comment that this statute doesn't really, there are different issues, and they are different issues, and the statute doesn't apply. But in an effort to try to get past this demur stage, there was this, you know, square peg being pushed in the round hole, if I get that right. I think that's how it goes. But you're trying to force this statute to set the standard here for how the water flows on a property from one higher lot to a lower lot. And that's not the standard. And the court kept telling counsel, I don't believe that's a standard. Show me the facts. And that statute kept getting inserted into all of the counts, saying this is the standard, and they violated that standard. So, you know, we are dealing with an issue where what's the remedy for putting mulch down on a piece of property around flower beds? If that's what's causing the problem, you'd be asking for a remedy, which is take your mulch off. Remove your mulch. Not come over here and keep all the water from a rainstorm from going onto our lot. The facts here are simply not sufficient for my client in this instance, Mr. Hale, who owns half of a duplex, whose lot happens to be higher than the plaintiff, and who didn't own the lot originally, didn't do any of this grading, but he can't even get to the point where he gets to address that because the year's not here. Curpial had the year. It starts off in 2007. This took place. And I can't tell you when exactly the case went to trial. I mean, I didn't look for that date, but I know the appeal was around 2011 or something in that range. So we're looking at a time frame that we could work with, but we could be dealing with something that's 20 years old as to when this grading was done, or 15 years old, and we don't know that.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Is it her essential claim that you didn't take the water off your property and throw it in the street? Isn't that essentially what her argument
is? Well, that's what they tried to push
right
when they originally just pled one thing.
And do you have a duty to do that in common law?
Under common law, you do not have a duty to do that. Under common law, it is, you know, everyone's trying to protect their own property from, this is not, that statute talks about water accumulating on the property, and the person on whose property the water accumulates has a duty to get that water off of the property. It doesn't talk about what happens with rainfall. Exactly how are we supposed to stop every drop of rainwater from going on to the property next door to us when that property is lower? The issue here is, what did Mr. Hale do to cause an undue amount of water to go to that property? And when we've been asked that question over and over and over again, when the plaintiff was asked that question over and over and over again, it came down to, well, he put mulch on the property. And he told me a couple times we were out there when it flooded, and the flooding was really bad on his property too, and he, you know, we tried to help each other, and when his was fixed, then he just didn't care about mine anymore. The punitive damages aspect of this case came in because, you know, there's a letter being sent by an attorney saying, get the water off the property. And the allegation is, since they didn't get the water off the property immediately, it must be intentional and willful and wanton because they didn't follow the instructions of the attorney letter. All of those issues were part of this demur, not just the fact that you know, the water was flowing in accordance, you know, pursuant to common law, you know, as permitted by common law. Every single case, with the exception of curpial, that listed specific facts, said 2007 they built this property and they did this to the elevation, they did this to the topography, they did this. Every other case has an instance where there was an affirmative action on the part of the plaintiff. For example, one school board, I think it's the Mullins case maybe, built a retention pond. I like to call that the toilet flush case because they kept flushing the retention pond, the contents of it, onto the next property. So it wasn't just an instance where the water was flowing. They committed an intentional act that forced that water over to the property. And,
right.
And most of the cases, except for
purposes. Has now expired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. Madam Clerk, add some time to Mr. Martingale to respond to two sets of parties on the other side. Put the clock at 5.
Thank you. I would like to first start by addressing the questions raised by Mr. Fiorello on behalf of his clients. If you look at page 134 of the joint appendix, you will see the specific time frames, not that I think they're required, but you will see the specific time frames and the allegations relating to Mr. Hale and the LLC he created. It points out that in 2008, the property manager for Hale received a number of complaints and communications from the City of Norfolk stormwater management folks. And then in the years following, the way that he decided to remedy it was to periodically dump mulch and make other modifications to the property in an effort to address water issues. However, instead of making reasonable efforts to direct water runoff to the street, the property was modified in such a manner that it actually increased water flow from Hale's property onto Collett's property. It goes on to explain the whole situation with the absence of drain pumps. There's no berm, there are no gutters, drain pipes, any type of effort to send this water
Council,
anywhere.
The only thing I don't understand about this is in every one of the other cases, the allegation was made that the surface water discharge was increased. And that was not enough. It had to be something more than that. And the more than that you have is someone's dumping gravel on a parking lot and someone's dumping mulch on their property. I just don't see how that could pass any of the older cases.
Well, it certainly would appear to pass Tate v. Ogg from 1938. That, at least there they got to a trial, and that dealt with animals, but they determined that on
the issue there was not the sufficiency of the pleading.
Right, and virtually all of the cases have been decided after trial evidence, whether at the trial court level or whether at the Supreme Court.
I heard that distinction earlier, but when an appellate court on a sufficiency analysis says the evidence was insufficient and says why, that sets the parameters of the cause of action. Now the only remaining question is whether or not you need to plead it. And as you've heard from the bench, you know, we've never been able to say with any clarity what the difference is between a conclusion of law and an allegation of fact for purposes of pleading. But here we have an ancient common law tradition that is very clear, and it is a heightened standard above and beyond typical negligence law. Why should you plead it?
Well, perhaps we could look at it this way. Right now, what we don't know is this. We don't know from the pleading the quantity of mulch that was dumped or how frequently. It says that it was periodically dumped and that the way the grading was handled and the topography was handled, it actually increased the flow. On the other side, we have 8 inches of gravel that were put down. Suppose it's 10 feet of gravel and a mountain of mulch. How much is the court supposed to do to figure out whether that was reasonable and necessary on pleadings? We have put the facts in as to what each neighbor did, and we say that it's unreasonable. For whether that's reasonable or unreasonable, that's ultimately for a trier of fact to determine. We didn't get to that stage. And that's the problem. We identified specific acts that were done. We described those as being unnecessary, unreasonable, reckless. And that they even made statements, both neighbors made statements indicating they didn't have a care in the world about the problem they were causing for Gina Cobb.
That seems to me to be more of an ad hominem than a legal argument. Suppose they didn't. What does it have to do with the legal standard?
Because the legal standard is you can't do things heedlessly with regard to your neighbor. In fact,
that's an objective standard. It doesn't matter what they were thinking or not thinking. It's what they did.
It also, I would contend, has to do with the intent. What degree of care are you exercising? Ordinary care is what's required in a negligence case. Suppose you proclaim to the world, I don't have any amount of care. I don't care what this does to you. And then we bring in experts who say, and oh, by the way, it wouldn't have been that complicated for you to handle your water in a different way. You could have tilted the grading differently. You could have put in a French drain. You could have done any number of things at minimal cost. But you, Mr. Neighbor, decided not to do any of those things. You cared only about yourself. And it seems that what is required is that you care to some degree. The modified rule would seem to require a trial, because the modified rule says that each landowner is capable of fighting off water as best he can, provided that the landowner does not do so in a manner that is unreasonable.
But
and
the
how
law
can that
has
unreasonable?
Defined the threshold already for that. It's not a car wreck case. The law has defined a certain threshold. You can develop your land, you can grade your land, you can put buildings on your land, and in each instance you can cause additional surface overflow as a matter of law. There's some outlier set of facts, like building berms and changing waterways, that may trigger the exception to the general rule, which is you don't get a recovery. It's modified, because if it weren't modified, you'd get nothing ever, even under mountain scenarios.
And it would appear to require some testimony and probably expert testimony to determine whether or not the manner in which the drainage was handled was done so in a reasonable manner or a reckless and destructive manner. And we believe that we've pled enough for that. And I see my time's expired. Thank you for the extra time. And thank you for your attention.
Call the next case.